This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Ronnie Pepper believes storytelling has the power to make young people feel confident. They see themselves as the protagonist, standing up to a bully, or maybe they imagine themselves on a great adventure, a marauding pirate, perhaps. What Ronnie emphasizes in his stories is perspective, stories from underrepresented points of view, like the story of the Kingdom of the Happy Land, an autonomous community in Appalachian North Carolina created by freed slaves in the years following emancipation. And Ronnie isn't shy about telling his own story either. It's one that starts in a four-room house with no plumbing in Hendersonville, North Carolina. I'll let him pick it up from there. Ronnie Pepper, welcome to State of Things. Good to have you here.
Good to be here, Frank. Good to be here. Yes, indeed.
Well, tell us about those early days growing up in Hendersonville.
Yeah, those early days, you know, a lot of times, you know, we don't know we're poor because there's no way of knowing. You don't have anything to compare it with. So everything that we had, this is the world. We thought, hey, everybody lives like this. And we had like a four-room house. And my grandmother and my grandfather, they had one room. And another room is where my aunt and my mother, they shared. And in one bed, it was me, my mama, my sister, and my brother. And in the other half of the room, my aunt and her three boys. And then in the living room was my uncles. They lived on they slept on a pull-out sofa. And it was David, James, Reuben, and Uncle Joe. And then there was a kitchen. And that's how we lived.
Everybody get along?
Hey, you had to. Because if you didn't, my grandmother was going to straighten things out.
I see.
Yes, indeed.
She was the matriarch.
She was the matriarch. She was.
So talk about what everybody was doing. How were they all making a living?
Well, basically, my uncle, he worked for an apple farmer. My uncle Reuben, he worked at the bus station, and he worked at the bus station. And as far as David, I didn't understand until I got a little older. He did a couple of jobs. One of the things that he did was cut chickens. You know, he did that. And then James, he did a little bit of everything. Mm-hmm. He just kind of moved from here to there. And he was the youngest. And so, you know, the youngest, sometimes they get to take a little leisure more than the older ones did.
They get a little babied, but there's a lot to do around the house,
a lot to do around the house. We cut wood. We had to tote water. And one of the things that I can remember, I knew that I would become a man once I was able to tote water like my Uncle Joe. And I could see his arms, his biceps just rippling, and he could carry two buckets at one time. And I said, man, I can't wait until grandmother says, Ron, go up there and fetch water. I need some. And that way I knew I was growing up and becoming a man.
What was that moment like for you? Did it happen?
It did happen. And I had one bucket, and it took me one time. I sloshed and got my shoes all wet, and I had to have two arms, and then I had to set it down, but I got it there. And eventually it got to the point where I could take a whole bucket and not even spill anything. And then it was two buckets. So
now, toting clean water might be a good job, but there was another job that had to be done periodically that you actually admired.
I admired, and that was helping with the outhouse. Because like we said, we didn't have any running water, and we had to have an outhouse. And just to see those men when it was time. And I think I only got to see it twice. I remember it twice. See the guy, all the men out there digging.
They had to move it,
exactly. Fill it up and then dig it and then move it. And I said, man, I just can't wait to do that. Other things I could do, chop wood. I learned how to chop wood, stack wood. That was one of the things that my grandmother had us do is a discipline. Hey, get out there and move that wood. But it wasn't a chore. After a while, you get your imagination gets to running. You got your little army men or your little cowboys, and you got the plan, and you got to find bugs that you'd never get to see that grew up in the grass, but in the wood. And it wasn't a chore.
Well, tell me more about that, about this idea of these unsavory tasks, seemingly unsavory tasks, that on the one hand for you are rites of passage. So you're seeing them in an entirely different way.
Yeah, it was a rite of passage because it showed responsibility, you know, and that was important. One of the things that my grandmother always said, she says, I don't care what you do, what you become, you just be good at it. She used to tell her uncles that because sometimes they'd have a little drinking problem. She said, listen, if you're going to be good, if you're going to be a drunk, be a good one. She said, just be good at it. You know, just don't be sloppy. Be good.
But tell me about the other part of that, the way your imagination worked and the stories that you might be telling yourself about what you're doing. And in addition to chopping wood, there's a whole narrative that's going around this in your mind.
Oh, man. You know, like, say, for instance, you know, just the chopping wood, just watching my granddad or my uncles chop, and they were able to hit that just right, and they could split it. And I said, man, I can't wait to do that. But then after a while, when you chop, you get to learn about the different types of wood, the soft wood, the oak wood, the pine. I know right now we don't burn pine. Yeah. But at our time, we had to burn whatever we could. And we'd rather not burn the pine, but it was the hardwood. And, man, it was just so fun. Sometimes when we stacked the wood, I would stack it, and when my brother got a little bit older, we would stack it so that it created a cave, or we would stack it so it built like a big tower, you know, and it got to a point where we could even had a little door we could go in between and had a little house and just play.
Always on a mission.
Always on a mission.
Your school integrated when you were in third grade, and I wonder what that was like for you.
For me, it wasn't... And you got to realize that at that age, at third grade, you know, everywhere I went, my grandmother always went with us, or my mama went with us. So there was like a shield or protection. Mm. So as long as you were young, she shielded you from the bad and the names and things like this. You heard them, but she was there as a protector. So during my time of integration, it wasn't that bad. I was young. I didn't have as much bad memories stored up. If you understand what I'm saying. Now, I talk with some of my older, you know, friends and cousins, and I listen to their stories where they were out and they were having to go out into the world by themselves, like go to the store. Mm. So they experienced life a little different. So when it was time for them to transition, you know, they had those a lot more bad memories held up, or individuals that they remembered and they trying to hold some of this anger and things back. So mine, it wasn't quite as bad.
And you had a good friend in my fourth grade. Talk about
I had a good friend. Actually, when we went to school, I got to be a safety patrol. That's what they call it, safety patrol. We had the hats, the army hats.
Oh, yeah. Did you have the belt?
Yes. We had a belt right across. It was blue, had the badge, you know. And we were chosen, and we had to stand up and stop traffic and help people cross the road. And at the beginning of the day, we had to go out, and we'd have to raise the flag. So it was wonderful. It was me and Dean Cagle and Casey Lejeune, Gene Young. Who else? It was one other person. I can't remember if it was Donnie Parks or not, but I think he might have been one. I'm not for sure. But we had a little team, and we keep people from running in the halls and whatnot. And I mean, we used to talk about that. Man, we the littlest ones here. Who gonna listen to us?
You got that badge.
We got the badge, but I mean, you know, and they will tell you, wait till you get out, take that badge off on your way home.
Well, now, Dean was a close friend among this group. And he went, talk about the sleepover, because he said, well, let's get together.
During that time, you know, and Dean Cagle, he was white, you know, and we got to be good buddies. And one reason why we got to be good buddies is because my thing was I always liked to get to school early. And I would start off walking. And my grandmother never let us walk by ourselves. She would walk with us up to a point, and then she'd watch us as we go down the hill. After I got a little bit older, my uncle would go out. He would go to work, and we would start off, and we'd have a race to see who could outwalk each other. And he let me go first, but then he'd eventually catch up with me. But anyway, me and Dean, we would get to school first. And whoever got there first, there was a guy that used to deliver the milk for cafeteria time. And when we got there and we helped him, he would give us chocolate milk, which we didn't get. Nowadays, the kids get a choice of chocolate or white milk. We didn't get that choice. But he would help us with that. And whoever got there first, they'd get that chocolate milk.
That's pretty good.
And me and Dean, through that, we got to be really good friends. And there was a time when he wanted to, he decided, he said, Ron, he says, I'm going to spend the night at your house. And that was just not something that I thought about. I mean, because here he was, I'm black, he's white, he's coming to my house. And think about it. We had four rooms, you know. Where was he going to sleep? Our bed was crowded enough. And then I was thinking, how is that going to make him feel? And then I've never slept with, anybody white before, you know. So it was a difficult thing. But he was determined that he was going to come. And he did come. And we walked home, and I remember us walking through the cemetery, and we was talking. But at that time, I didn't tell my grandmother. You know, my heart was just beating. What was I going to say? But he got there, and we kind of played outside, and I was thinking all the time, where is he going to sleep? What's he going to think about when he goes in to use the bathroom and whatnot? There's no running water. What are we going to eat, you know? Because you see things on TV.
Yeah.
And on TV during those times, you didn't see any black families. All you saw was white families, and Leave It to Beaver, Father Knows Best. And they all lived, and everybody had their own room, had running water, the whole nine yards. And I just assumed this is how he lived. But, you know, even during that time, I can't remember or recall him showing any kind of negativity or anything like that. He just wanted to play. But it didn't last long, because I don't know how, but his daddy ended up showing up. I don't know if my grandmother called. He called my grandmother. I don't know how that happened. I would love to find out. But anyway, his daddy showed up, and he cried. And it was a sad point. And for me, it was also sad, because I wanted him to stay, but then I didn't want him to stay. You know?
Yeah.
But
I wonder about the episode itself and his father. I mean, was it kind of like, no, I'm sorry, we have to go, or grab him by the ear? I mean, how did that?
No, it was very, I think it was very cultured. Dean, you can't stay. We got to go home, you know, and that's how it ended.
You got a job with the YMCA, and that's interesting, because that had just recently integrated, right?
Yes. So probably so. The YMCA, but started out working for a neighborhood youth corps. And that was for, just a government program to give opportunities for low-income families, to kids that could work from the age of 14 up to 18, 19, 20, earn money for helping their families buy food or buy clothing and whatnot. Mm. So my first year working was with Carl Sandburg's home. So I worked there for that first summer. The next summer was the YMCA, because I used to hang out to the Y all the time. And you couldn't go into the Y unless you had a membership. Well, we couldn't afford a membership. But I would do whatever I could to hang around. It got so bad that my friends would say, Mr. Tom Hetrick was the YMCA director. And they say, that's your daddy. Because I just, whatever he asked to do, I would do it. I mean, you know. And eventually, he asked for me to come and work at the Neighborhood Youth Corps. And then that's where I worked as a day camp counselor at the age of 15.
And where you developed your skill as a storyteller.
And that's where I developed my skill as a storyteller, because Patsy Rhodes was the director of day camp. And we'd do all kind of activities in the morning. About lunchtime, between 12 and 1, we'd go back to the game room, and we would have lunch. And then after lunch, we say, we got to take at least a 30-minute rest. And then Patsy, one day, she said, Ron, you ought to get in there and tell some stories. And so I started doing that. And from that, I had to go into, I had to learn more stories. And sometimes I'd make stories up. And, man, we just had the best time. And we look forward to that time. I look forward to that time. I start visiting the library and reading the grandfather, Richard Chase tales. And then one time, I found out about how you could make paper from grass. And so to incorporate that into the story of pirates finding the kids would find a map, and I made a map out of grass, and I pressed it out, and it made paper, and then I drew it, and I burnt the edges to make it look authentic, and I used that as a prop. And man, don't you know, the eyes of the kids just just got big, and they wanted to hear the story again and again, and it just got bigger and bigger.
Did you have any sense out of that that this is, might be some part of what you wanted to do, a writer, storyteller, actor, any of that in this moment?
No, it was just for entertainment.
Yeah.
And it made me feel good because I was good at it. Yeah. And it just made me feel good. What I really wanted to do from that, I wanted to be a director of a YMCA because they had a lot of activities going on. I helped coach 6-7-year-olds at basketball. And my thing was to have fun and allow every child to participate, because I wasn't the best athlete. And if you ever known when you get around in school, they always choose.
Yeah.
I was always one of the last ones chosen.
Yeah. And you will also say that in high school you weren't necessarily the best student.
No, I wasn't the best student, although I went 12 years without missing a day in high school. But I loved school, but I wasn't. And it wasn't that I didn't have the ability. I just didn't apply myself. Yeah. And I think a lot of that had to do with not having a role model to really push me as far as doing better. Because at that time, my grandmother was raising me, and my grandmother was, she passed away at the age of 93, either 93 or 96, depending on which birth certificate or way you looked at that birth certificate. But at that time, when I was at that teenage age, she was, you know, she encouraged us to go to school, encouraged us to do better, but she wasn't one that could help. Sometimes I question about how much she could read, you know? I never asked, but I question that.
So you go through high school, you get through, you didn't miss a day, although you weren't there when they were taking the picture for a perfect attendance.
I missed that.
What's
I
this
missed
all
that
about?
Certificate. I don't know. I just missed it. At that time, you know, you get with your buddies and they tell you they're going to take pictures, but you don't even pay attention to it. So I wasn't there. I was out doing something else. And at that time, about that 12th grade, I decided, you know, I need to go to college. But without applying your ability, you can't wait till the last minute and decide that you're going to go to college, because then that's when life really points out and say, look, you know, you don't have the grades. You got the ability. You just didn't study. You didn't apply yourself.
So this gets you into the Army.
And so I said, hey, listen, my cousin had went into the military and he came back with his GI Bill. And I said, I can do that. And so that's why I went. I didn't tell any of my buddies I was going. Neil, Pete, you know, none of those guys, JC, I just went.
You went, you did your best, although there was one moment where you dropped your weapon.
Oh, Fort Jackson. Yes, indeed. Drill Sergeant Wright. We had been out on the firing range. And, you know, you always have your weapon on you. You can't drop it. You can't lay it down. You got to always be with that weapon. And we was in formation, and I don't know what happened, but it dropped, and it went bang. And I reached down and I snatched it up so quick, I was like, Flash. You couldn't even hit it. You turn around, who dropped that weapon? And nobody said anything. I said, oh, I'm in the clear now. He says, okay, everybody, drop. Give me 20. And by that time, fingers pointed. Pepper, it was Pepper. It was Pepper. I went, oh, no. He said, Pepper got in my face. Oh, man, he gave me the up and down. He said, now you get down and you give me 20. And by that time, I had the prone position, but the weapon had to lay across my hands. And I had to, I love you, M16A1. I love you, M16A2. And I had to keep pushing and pushing. And finally, he said, get up. He said, now tell it you love it. And I said, I love you, M16. He said, now kiss it. And I went, He said, no, I want you to give it some tongue. And everybody, they was in formation. They couldn't say a word, but I said, oh, oh. And then we marched on. And each step I took, I could hear them snickering. Everybody snickering. Pepper, how was that kiss? Give that French kiss. M16 tongue.
Yeah. Never dropped that again.
I never dropped it again.
You're stationed in Germany.
Yes. Yeah. Got in a station in Germany, and one of the things, going over it, it's a story. Because somehow I lost my, went in December. I mean, we had to fly out in December on a Friday. Lost my ID. Left it at the house. And you can't get on the plane without it. So you had to wait till Monday. Well, guess what? I ain't have no money. It was about four of us in there. We was in there, and we couldn't sleep in the airport, but we did everything that we could. We ended up pitching together and buying a can of peanuts. And we said, listen, this has got to last us until Monday. So we would portion them out.
Where were you for this? Huh? This is before you're leaving.
This is before we was leaving. This was in Colombia. Wow. Yes, indeed.
Well, you did get there, and that was kind of a difficult tour in a way, because the Vietnam War was going on.
Actually, they had stopped. When I went into the military, they stopped sending people in May, right. And I went in July. And people were coming from Vietnam and Germany. That one base was one of the stops, and they didn't debrief the guys. So here you had individuals that had spent time in war, and it was difficult. You know, a lot of drinking, a lot of drugs. There wasn't it was a small concern, a post. There wasn't a lot to do. So,
did you find yourself getting in trouble?
Close to it. And I realized, I said, listen, I've got to turn myself around, because if I don't, I'm going to end up like some of these guys. Mm-hmm. And I stayed over there for almost about 18 months. And out of the 18 months, you'd be surprised how many people you see leave, but I've only seen two people leave because their time was up. The rest of them was either drug discharge or Article 15s. And I said, I can't be one of those. My grandmother would, whoo, and then I wouldn't accomplish my goal.
Well, it's a telling story in and of itself, because, you know, you're not experiencing the trauma directly, but
no.
You're taking it on as these people are coming through.
Yes.
And you can at least read the fact that it's having an effect on
it
them.
Has an effect on them. And this was before we knew about traumatic stress syndrome, you know. But now when I look back, I can say, yeah, I could see it.
What about the return? Because that wasn't easy for you either.
No, once I got back, you know, I went to work at Kimberly-Clark, but that was not something I wanted to do. And during that time, you know, I've always been a worker. I had to have, you know, I guess it was part of your self-esteem to be a work, you know, to be able to work hard. Mm. And that was something that my grandmother pressed into me. I seen it with my uncles. Regardless what they did, they were always on the job, you know, helping with the family. They were supportive. I mean, they earned money and to help their mother and even us. And there got to be a point where it was just depressing. I didn't have a job. You know, picking up day jobs, you know, Allied van lines, unloading furniture. But it wasn't the same. It wasn't 40 hours a week, 8 hours a day, 5 days a week. And you get depressed. And I know there's a back we used to believe, you know, hey, you know, one thing that you don't have to worry about, you never see black people getting depressed. You never see black people, you know, committing suicide. But that's not true. It happens. You just don't hear about it. And it was during that time that I was depressed. Tried to take my life. And it was with a bottle of sleeping pills. The only thing that probably saved me is I wasn't working, so I have a lot of money, you know, and it happened. But, you know, not with the outcome that I wanted. So, and now I think back, I said, man, what would have happened if I really would have died? It would have been in my best friend's house. You know, what pain would that have caused him? What pain would that have caused his mother, who is just like my second mother? What pain would that have caused my mom and my grandmother? And I was depressed.
What brought you out of it?
My friends. JC, Jesse Cauley, Bob, Jeffrey, Eddie. One day they came to my house. I was just sitting. They said, listen, you going with us? And I said, no, I ain't going. Yes, you are. You might as well get dressed. You ain't having you sitting around the house. So they took me over to the Orange Peel, which that's where we used to go.
In Asheville.
Mm-hmm. And that's where I met my wife. And I prayed. I said, you know, if I had someone to be my mate, you know, to be my helper. And in the Word. I was always in the Word because my grandmother always took us to church, my mother as well. And there was always, the Lord always wanted you to have a workmate. And that's why I met my wife and turned it around.
Wow.
Turned it around.
Did you start dating right away? Did it take a while to get that going?
Hey, listen. I got there. I found out her number, and I wrote it down on a piece of paper. I held it so tight. By the time I got back to Hendersonville, I couldn't even read the number. I couldn't read the number on the piece of paper. I said, oh, my goodness, what am I going to do? And we got creative. That's during the time of operators. So you dial up operator. Guess what? We need a phone number for 265 Pearson Drive. Last name is Harper. And her brother's had an accident in the Army. And we need the number so we can get in touch with him. Operator didn't buy it. Had a friend. He didn't buy it. We did it. I did it about two or three different operators, you know, because you never get, you hope with somebody, you get somebody that would work with you. But it didn't happen. I had a friend, Pop Pete, he's passed away now, but he knew Asheville. And I told him the address. He took us right over there on a Sunday.
Wow.
Winter morning, cold. And we met at the door, showed up right out of the blue. And it was wonderful. And
well, it worked out. You got married, and you did get a job eventually as a Head Start teacher, right?
Yes. Went as a Head Start teacher right after I got my certification. First, I went to Haywood Community College Recreation because I really wanted to be a YMCA director in recreation. But it didn't work out. So after I got that degree, Randy Guy said, hey, they've got a degree over in Hendersonville, Blue Ridge Community College, as a child care worker. And I work with children. Right. I went and got that degree, got hired on as a teacher, a lead teacher with Head Start.
And then eventually librarian as well, right?
Yep. That was back in probably 14, if I'm not mistaken.
All right. So that was wild. So talk about that role as a Head Start teacher, because that was a program, kind of a preschool program, right?
It was a preschool. Loved it. Yeah. And one reason I loved it was because I got to do everything that I wanted to do. I could be a doctor. I could be a lawyer. I could be a teacher. I could be a nurse. I could be it all because with the kids, you had to do it all. A cook, man. We used to throw down with some breakfasts in the mornings for the children, because with Head Start, nutrition was very important, and I would make sure that those kids got fed good, even though they said you had to have this, and this. I would have extra because I knew how important it was. I knew what it was like when I was growing up, and how that really set the day.
Were there many other men in that position at the time?
At that time, probably not. I was probably one of the, in our area, I was the only one, a male. They may have had a bus driver, but even then, the bus driver, Priscilla, she's a woman. The teachers, a lot of times, they drove the bus and taught. So I was probably one of the first male teachers. Yeah. We used to go to conferences down here in Greensboro, and I mean, I never had any problems when it was time to use the restroom after a workshop going into the bathroom because I didn't have to wait in line.
Yeah. Didn't have to wait.
That's exactly right.
This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio talking with Ronnie Pepper, a Hendersonville-based storyteller and librarian. And perhaps the story he is most well known for is The Kingdom of the Happy Land, a self-sufficient community formed by freed slaves in the mountains of North Carolina, not too far from his home. How did you come across that story? When did you first hear about that?
Well, you know, you hear about little things like that when you're growing up with parents, your grandparents, they talk about things, but you don't pay attention. And it wasn't until we had formed a group, my wife and several of us, and we wanted to do a Black History celebration. So we developed a committee, celebration committee, in which Black History Month, we do programs. Mm. We started off in February, but then we started doing things a couple times throughout the year. And we had a, Joe Miller wrote a play, Kingdom of Happy Land, and she based it off of the research that she'd done. And by doing the play, it not only it was entertaining, but it educated us to the history of the Kingdom of Happy Land.
So tell us about it.
And then, it was individuals from right after the Civil War, the Emancipation, and Robert Montgomery left Mississippi. And we don't know exactly how many. It started out not freedmen now.
Yeah.
Maybe 20, 25. But by the time that they got to Green River, it was over between 150 to 200, slaves, but black people.
Yeah.
And they wanted to create a village like in Africa. Now, if you can think back, there was individuals that probably had memories of what the villages were like in Africa and how people were communal. And they wanted to develop a place where they could use their skills, they could survive and thrive and be free and didn't have to worry about persecution. And that's what they did.
Yeah.
And it started out, and I can imagine it starting out with 50, and then all of a sudden you're going, people, where y'all going? You know, we're going to find us a place. And individuals dropping in, creating large numbers, and others, I can't go any further. And they're dropping out until you get to this place. And I imagine that as they got to South Carolina, they probably ran across into blacks that had been up in the area and knew about the area and say, hey, there's property up here. I used to be when I was a slave, we visited there. We had a plantation. And until they got here. And they used their skills.
Located for us. Where is it?
Located.
It's near Tuxedo.
It's so near Tuxedo. Yes, right on the border of South and North Carolina. Mm-hmm. People say that was strategic, how it was based on the line, because if they had problems in North Carolina, they could just move over to South and vice versa. And if you think about it, you think about the slaves. When they were slaves, they did, they were artisans. They were cooks. They created things. If there was a problem with a shear, or they were blacksmiths. Right. They created things. They built things. So they had the skills, except now they were doing it for themselves. And also Miss Davis. And she was the one that allowed them to be on the property, and then eventually they bought that property. And I think there's a deed in North Carolina, the Hendersonville records, where they purchased that property.
So
they stayed.
What do we know about it? How long did it last, and kind of what kinds of activities?
Somewhere between 1867, 68, somewhere in there. They worked for some of the families to earn money, as the Poseys. But at the same time, Miss Davis, at one point, there was a place where people stopped because the traveling, the Buncombe County Turnpike ran right straight through there from South Carolina up. And if you go in Asheville, you had to come that way. And people was driving the cattle, the crops to market. And that was a steep way. So these individuals would help people get up that grade. And not only that, but have a place that they could stop and rest and get meals. They also, there was a tonic that they were known for to create that would help with rheumatism and things of that nature. They worked around the area for families earning money and piling it together so that they could purchase this property.
They got about, how large was the property?
They said anywhere between 150 to 200 acres. Yeah. If you look at different places, they say.
Right. Well, I guess that brings us, forgive me for interrupting, but,
no.
But that does bring us to the research and kind of how we know
exactly
what's available and
exactly
how do we know what we
There's
know.
Not a whole lot that's available, because if you think about it, during that time, blacks were not, it was against the law for them to write.
Right.
So individuals, they couldn't write. And people say, well, how come they just didn't pay taxes? The court system was not a very friendly place to blacks. So they wanted a place where they could be all for themselves. And plus, they didn't have that knowledge. You know, you had one or two that worked on a plantation or in the house that might gather the information by listening and being present, but not really actually knowing. But then once you walk through the door, it's a lot different.
Yeah.
You know, you would treat it differently. So there's not a lot that's written. And that's one of the things why I like to tell stories and do a little bit more research. Suzanne is helping me do some research. We get together about once a week and we go through the census and we're looking at some of the names that were on the census records, or we know that we're at Kingdom of Happy Land, and finding out individuals, who their parents were, where they were born or where they died, and trying to track their ancestors, because it's not written.
How about the oral tradition? How many stories are around, and who's telling those stories? Anybody?
There's probably not a whole lot of stories that's all around. I know I'm telling the stories, and I'm listening to other people, but there's not a lot.
And do we know what happened eventually and how it dissolved?
We have to use a little bit of our imagination, but we also have to use what's happening during that time. At that time, you know, it was right after the war. People weren't traveling much, but then they were. Then came the railroad, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And so as the railroad was coming, people didn't have to use their wagons to get back to market. They started using the railroad. And then you had the towns that started shifting. And if you think about it, as you know, you growing up, when you say you live in New York, you say, man, I can't wait to get out of New York.
Mm-hmm.
I want to go on my own. This place ain't happening for me. Think about those young people. They didn't want the same life for their parents. They didn't want to maybe be farmers. They wanted education because now they were free.
Right.
We talked about being free and having the right to go to school and be able to vote, even though it was still not there, but it was a vision. And you could not do it possibly on in that communal, that community. So you had to branch out. Plus you wanted to go someplace where you could make a living, you know, have a family of your own.
Well, and a very different set of rules out there in terms of investment and wealth building.
Exactly.
And again, if you thought for a minute that you really had an equal opportunity, and that was maybe the moment when it looked like a story that was, you know, that was an honest story and you could believe.
Yes.
Yes, it's not how we play our game.
Yes.
You can understand that in that moment, with that kind of a vision, that may not be the place for you.
Exactly. And now you can believe in, you can see a horizon that may be brighter on the other side. Same thing is with the Great Migration from the South. The blacks had from the South to the North. They believed that it was different, and that they could once they got there, they could live a totally different life, better than the one that they had. And I'm guaranteeing that the people that lived on the kingdom was the same way.
Why is it important to you to tell this story?
Because it tells our young people that you can have a vision, and you can, and if you, you know, you just got to map it out. And if you believe it, you will receive it. And this is what these guys did, and you have to work together. And I think for our black young people, they need to know that, you know, what they learn in books, you know, they were slaves. But these slaves had skills. They had abilities. They had a mind. And that's not what's talked about a lot of times that they don't hear in school, or it's not written straight out. You've got to read between the lines. You've got to read some of the biographies of these individuals. Mr. Robinson, who was known as the brown condor that helped start the Tuskegee Airmen. He was one of a pilot, and he knew how important it was and how he learned how to fly a plane. And he went to Chicago and he cleaned an office or a school just so where they were teaching young men how to fly. But he couldn't. But he stood in the back and he learned by cleaning the room and just by watching. And he built his own plane, him and a couple of his buddies.
Yeah, one of the fascinating untold stories in American history is in the 1920s, anyway, the number of African Americans with pilot licenses who owned airplanes, and in a state like Oklahoma, actually outnumbered whites in plane ownership.
Yes.
I mean, it's an odd little nugget, but wow, think that through,
yes.
You know.
And think how important it is for the kids to hear this. You know, not only black boys, but girls and everybody, you know, to learn this. And it's not about, there's a story where this little kid was at a fair, and this man, he was selling balloons, and when business got slow, he let a balloon up. And then people come around, they buy, and then they drift away. He let up another balloon. They'd come by. And this one little black kid was sitting there, and he watched him. He walked up to him and said, "Mister, say, if you let go of a black balloon, would it rise up like that?" And he said, "Son," he says, "it's not the color of the balloon," he says, "but it's what's inside." And that's what we need to tell our people so they can hear these stories. You know, the Buffalo Soldiers and, oh, man, it's so many of these stories that we don't hear about.
Well, talk about the stories, because I know you have your own organization, a storyteller, something called Pepper's Promise.
And yes.
That's the umbrella under which you work. Talk about some of the other stories that you tell and are part of the repertoire.
You know, even, like, say, for instance, Men of Honor. I like to do that story. And you know about Carl Brashear, and he was the first master diver. Cuban junior, I think he played him. I get a uniform and I tell that story, and I tell how important, you know, I tell that story, but it's like a theatrical. Mm-hmm. I become that person. I do that when I do John Robinson as the pilot, the Brown Condor. Do that one as well. I want to do another individual that they say is the basis for the Lone Ranger. Not a bounty hunter, but he was a lawman.
Yeah, yeah.
And they said his story is, the Lone Ranger is based on his story because he had almost 2,000 arrests.
Wow.
He only got his belt buckle shot off one time.
Wow.
But he was an amazing person. But you don't hear about black cowboys. And if I'm not mistaken, one out of four or one out of five in the West were black, you know. But we don't hear those stories. When we see the Westerns, you know, we don't see that. And I think that would just, man, what that would do to our young people. And everybody needs to know these stories.
Well, and you also go back. I mean, there's an Aesop's fable that you like to tell
The wind. I do a lot of stories, but I put a spin on it. Like it was the competition between the sun and the wind, but I do it as the first bully, because in school now we're talking about bullying, and the first bully was the wind, and how the wind has got power and is strong and destructive, but he's also braggadocious and always boasting, and the sun finally says, "Listen, you know, you got to stop this," and so they do a competition about the man that has the coat on, who can take it off. Wind says, "I'll snatch it, I'll whip it from the east to the west, I'll drag it through the ocean, I'll fling it so far, he won't ever be able to find it." But it doesn't happen that way. The sun individually ends up beating him. And the wind is so distraught, he says, "I'm nothing." He says, "I'm just weak, you're more powerful." He says, "No, wind." He says, "You're still powerful, you're still destructive. You just have a little compassion. You don't have to brag about it. You the wind. You got to be the wind. But you just don't have to, you know, push it in people's face."
Powerful stuff.
Yeah.
Hey, before I let you go, I know that you've got some thoughts about libraries, too, because you're a librarian.
I'm a librarian. Yeah. And I tell you what, the things that's happening in our library system is wonderful. We got the NC Digital. The ancestry that's happening, that individuals can go in and they can look up histories, they can look up photos and learn so much, our young people. And the way that the library is changing now, because our society is changing, and we got to adapt with that. And I know sometimes it's not as, it's not what we remember it being,
mm-hmm.
But that doesn't mean it can't be better. And we open our doors for everybody. And it's just a wonderful place to be.
Ronnie Pepper, a Hendersonville storyteller and a librarian, also the owner, I guess you could say, of Pepper's Promise.
Pepper's Promise.
Ronnie is from Hendersonville, North Carolina, and you can find out more about his work at our website, stateofthings.org. Movies on the Radio, if you want to be on the next show, you can send us an email at sot@wunc.org. If you've got a favorite movie that somehow evokes place, you know, a movie like, say, Old Bull Durham, any movie that talks about a place, a city, a region that really tells the story of that place and was important to you, send us an email at sot@wunc.org, or you can go to Twitter and Facebook with the hashtag SOTMovie, and you can be on the next Movies on the Radio. State of Things produced by Anita Rao, Amanda Magnus, Grant Hall of Mormon, Katie Barron, and Josie Taras. Jenny Lawson is our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.